Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela, and I'm excited today to welcome Tim Keller. Tim is the Senior Vice President and Legal Director at the Center for the Rights of Abused Children. Welcome, Tim.
Oh, thank you, Angela. It's so wonderful to be here.
So Tim and I are friends and colleagues and just spent some time together in Idaho, which was really fun. So shout out to our friends, our new friends in Idaho. It was a
great time. And I was so grateful to you and to Jim and John for being out there. It was absolutely wonderful time.
It was a great. And I think people from Idaho might be the nicest I've ever met. I don't know how your experience was.
just the most incredible hospitality. I don't think we could have asked for a more welcoming environment and an opportunity to share this work and hopefully help elevate the practice for everybody who's working on behalf of those kids in Idaho.
Yeah, it was great. Well, let's jump right in. Before we get to our main topic today, I just wanted to give you a chance to tell our audience a little bit about the work of the center, what you guys are doing, and then we'll get right into our constitutional law discussion.
Oh, well, thanks, Angela. I'm so delighted to tell your listeners a little bit about the work of the Center for the Rights of Abused Children. I sometimes break our work down into three different buckets: what I often call the micro, the macro, and the super macro. So our micro work is that we operate a pro bono children's law clinic where we represent kids who are in foster care, we represent bio parents, we represent kinship placements, and we even represent foster parents from time to time. You know, we're entirely funded by private donations, so we have a lot of flexibility in determining the cases that we take. Our macro work is our policy work. So we work in state legislatures and at the federal level to pass policies like Counsel for Kids. We helped pass a law in Arizona several years ago to ensure that every child in foster care has a client-directed counsel. We've worked on similar issues in Kansas and Missouri, who have passed legislation to give older kids in care client-directed counsel. So we're really proud of that work and other issues that we work on. And then our super macro is litigating constitutional rights on behalf of kids, asserting issues like right to family integrity, rights to safety, rights to timely permanency, those types of issues. And I have the privilege of doing that, not just in Arizona, where we have our pro bono children's law clinic, but all across the country.
Yeah, and that's amazing. You know, one of the reasons I was so excited about this conversation is that what we like to do in our podcast is bring people new tools, like new ways that we can use our legal skills to advance the rights of children. And I think a lot of times, I know at least when I was in court every day or 3 days a week with my, you know, huge caseload, you're kind of just in reaction mode doing the next thing and the next thing. And we lose sight of what we as lawyers, of the power there and the power in tapping into the foundational documents and all of that. And so I wanted to just get people thinking today about how to root some of their work in what the Constitution provides for children. And so on that note, I've heard you speak multiple times and I would encourage anyone who gets the opportunity to do that. But can you just kind of give an overview of how you look at the rights of children under state and federal constitution?
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind, I'll tell a quick story. When I transitioned over to this work, it began over a cup of coffee with my friend Darcy Olson, who is the founder and CEO of the Center for the Rights of Abused Children. And she was telling me about a case that one of her foster kids was involved with. And in that case, the judge began a hearing by, quote unquote, reminding everybody in the courtroom that mom's rights were constitutional and the baby's were merely statutory. And so Darcy had asked me, you know, as a friend, is that right? And, you know, immediately I said, no, the Constitution applies to children as well as adults. They have legal rights, constitutional rights, liberty interests at stake in these proceedings that have to be respected by judges. But that conversation got me reflecting on my own time involved in the foster care system, because at the time my wife and I were licensed foster parents. And as I got to thinking about it, very, very, very rarely did we ever hear the notion that kids are protected by the Constitution in these cases, that they have rights to family integrity, to safety, like to timely permanency. These are important issues to these kids. And at the time, I had a young lady in our home, you know, in foster care, who had been in the system for 5 years. She had entered care when she was 3. She was 8 when she came to live with us. We were her 9th placement. And just reflecting on that conversation really led me to leave my prior work, where I was doing constitutional litigation, and join the center. And really the goal when I joined was to ensure that we would be arguing that kids have constitutional rights in their cases.
Yeah. Well, and I think that the truth of the matter is, like any appellate work that folks can do, a lot of times due to caseloads or resources or whatever, you know, it's just not top of mind in the day-to-day practice. But if we could really win some of these and get some more case law out there and across different states, it would make it a lot easier. And I think for everybody to be having at least a basic understanding and starting to take some steps to protect those rights is critical, which is what we're talking about today. So with that, from your perspective, as you, you know, look at these cases, what do you think the dependency lawyer doing, you know, case upon case upon case, if they've decided, yes, I believe you, I want to get in on this, where would you have them start?
Yeah, I would have them start by rooting many of their everyday arguments in the text of the Constitution. And what I mean by that is what you basically see from parents' lawyers all the time. If a parent's lawyer is going to file a motion, you know, for example, asking for additional visitation time, they will often start that brief by citing Santosky versus Kramer, a very famous U.S. Supreme Court decision that says that parents have a constitutional right to preserve their relationships with their children and for the state to make reasonable efforts to preserve that relationship. And it's always, you know, one of the very earliest things in cases they cite. But there are actually a fair amount of precedent out there indicating that kids have rights, reciprocal rights to family integrity. So, you know, you may want to join in that motion and file a response and say, like, yes, our clients support this motion because they have a similar reciprocal right. Or you may oppose it because you have safety concerns. And there's constitutional law out there that says kids who are in foster care have a right to safety. And so you root your argument opposing that motion in that case law, and then go on to explain the facts and the concerns you might have with however it is that you need to respond in that situation on behalf of your client, just beginning by rooting those arguments in the Constitution. And that's what I started doing when I came over to the center. Even though Darcy brought me over to, you know, to engage in constitutional litigation, one of the favors I asked of her was to spend some time in our pro bono children's law clinic, as you say, as a line attorney, just litigating these cases day in and day out. Because I had seen them from the perspective of a foster parent, but right, I had never litigated them in the context of an attorney. And I was so grateful for that opportunity because it is such fast-paced, constantly changing work. It can be, and you know, you're in court for long periods of time. When you're out of court, you're driving between houses to see your clients. You're engaging in conversations with counsel for the state or for the child welfare agency or for your parents. And it can be a really demanding and taxing and time intensive practice. And at the same time, here I am saying, oh, you should be asserting constitutional issues and doing additional legal research. And really, as a best practice, preserving those arguments in the form of a written motion, that's a daunting task. And so, yeah. Even though I'm out there advocating for this, I didn't want to leave anybody without some starting point. So I actually drafted and published what I call a practice manual. I mean, it's a short, you know, less than 100-page guide to lawyers on how they can assert, argue, and appeal the constitutional rights of kids. And a big part of that is just collecting the case law in bullet point format so that they can see the different cases that protect different rights, so that, you know, they could have it in court and they could open it up and at least preserve the argument, and then, you know, maybe file a written motion afterwards, which I discovered was a fairly common practice in juvenile court. You know, you hear something, you've got to object, you've got to, or, you know, make a motion and then, you know, tell the court you'll file a written pleading after the hearing.
I'm glad you brought it up because I have it right here on my desk. And I want to recommend this to folks because I love your idea of starting the practice by maybe joining a parent's motion. Because again, if folks aren't in the practice of filing written motions, that's a great way to kind of get started. You know, you're kind of joining in. this book that you have written, which I, again, have right here in my hands, is a tremendous resource and really does the work for people. So I want to tell our audience how they can, whether it can be downloaded or how they can get a copy, because this is, if you, you know, want to get started, you just really do need this resource.
Yes. So it is a free, available resource that can be downloaded on our website, which is thecenterforchildren.org. And so anybody is free, welcome to download that. They're also free to contact us, and I'm happy to send them a hard copy. We've had plenty of them printed. I usually like to distribute copies to anybody who attends one of the trainings that we do, so mm-hmm. that they can have a physical copy in their hand. We designed it to be a kind of a small booklet, again, so that they can have it in court with them as a resource if necessary, and that it would just be a real easy, accessible tool. So, they can email the center at intake@thecenterforchildren.org and request a hard copy, and we'd be glad to mail them one, no problem, no charge. We really do want to help those who are in the trenches, on the front lines, making these arguments on behalf of kids. And I think we designed the manual to be pretty user friendly. So there are some tips about best practices for filing and writing motions, and we discuss five specific rights for kids: the right to safety, the right to family integrity, the right to timely permanency, the right to emotional security, and also children's right to an education. And we recognize that kids have other rights that might be asserted, and many of the citations just talk about general due process or equal protection provisions applying to those kids. So those cases can be cited at a more macro level in appropriate circumstances. But it's intended to be a starting point and to really whet people's appetites and get them acclimated to, again, just rooting their everyday arguments in the soil of the federal and state constitutions.
We will put links in the show notes for anybody that wants to either download or request a copy. I know lawyers tend to be some of the few that still like the paper and like want to tab it and highlight it. So I appreciate that you are willing to do that. I know I love my paper copy. But yes, we'll put those links in. Yeah, I do think that the kind of reminding people about the state rights as a separate avenue for folks is really important, because I think, again, if you're not regularly practicing constitutional law, you tend to only think of the federal constitution.
Well, and those state constitutional provisions, just as a matter of history, were intended to be the primary protectors of individual rights. And mm-hmm. It wasn't until many states failed to protect rights that the 14th Amendment was added and made various provisions of the federal constitution applicable against the state and state action. And so there really are just many untapped state constitutional provisions that are just ripe to be interpreted and applied in a protective manner for kids, for any individual right, honestly. And I think there's also been a real renewed interest among state Supreme Court justices in looking at their state constitutions and interpreting them independent of the federal constitution and really looking at their own text, history, and language and determining, does our constitution perhaps protect rights in a manner that's even more protective of the federal constitution? So the federal constitution sets that floor, but we haven't even begun to approach the ceiling of what state constitutions might be able to do in terms of applying to protect individual rights.
I think that's exciting when you're in this area where, like you said, there's so much opportunity and so many things that haven't been tried, to really go to your state constitution to look in there and see how the language differs. Is it better for kids? Is it an easier argument? Is the case law better? So I think it's a tremendous opportunity, untapped, as you said.
Yes. Well, and one area where I think that really come into play recently is, as I'm aware of at least two cases, one that some friends are working on and one that we're working on, where children who are in foster care have been affirmatively precluded from attending court by the judges in those cases. And the lawyers who represent those kids are making arguments that the children have a due process right to attend their own proceedings. But I also know that they at least discussed the possibility of asserting state constitutional rights, because at least in one of those two cases, the state constitution has language saying that kids have, or that everybody has a right to access the courts. So that mm-hmm. right of access to courts provision is an interesting independent opportunity to say, no, even if the federal due process clause doesn't protect this right, the state constitutional provision does. And so it is a real opportunity out there for lawyers to make important constitutional arguments on behalf of their clients.
Well, I think that the right to attend court is a good one for people to look at. Now, there are certainly places throughout the country where kids routinely attend on a regular basis, but I still hear many, many places where it's sort of not the practice, or kind of like the cases you mentioned where people, whether it's the judge or someone else in the courtroom, argues that it's not in their best interest to be there. And so I think it's a great place to start. For the attorneys out there who's maybe that this is an issue for them. So let's say that either someone's objecting, or it's just not a matter of practice. I mean, you hear everything from, well, we can't get them there, to, you know, there's barriers that people use as an excuse to deny due process. And then there's like the actual arguments about why they shouldn't be there for, you know, their best interest or whatever. So if someone's in that situation, how would you recommend they go about starting to lay the groundwork? And obviously they should look at their state constitution, but then like in the courtroom, you know, where would they begin?
Well, you know, in the case that we're involved with, it came as a surprise to the lawyer who was representing the child. And the motion to exclude was made by the child's GAL, who was in that situation, a lay individual, not an attorney, but the GAL felt it was not in the child's best interests to be part of the hearing. Generally, the fact pattern is that this child, both of this child's parents have passed. And so she is a genuine orphan, and she wants to go live with family. And the GAL was going to oppose that desire and was going to argue that it's in her best interest to remain with foster placement. And of course, the attorney is advocating for the move, because that's what his client wants, and there's no safety issue that we're aware of or have seen. But it came as a surprise that the GAL asked the child to be removed from the courtroom during this argument and this discussion. So what this attorney did was just made a general due process argument. I think most lawyers, you know, would be able to quickly say that like the irreducible minimum of due process is the right to be present, or the right to be heard, at least in your own case. And that there would be an attendant right to be present. And in that case, because the due process issue was raised in a generalized fashion, the court like hit pause on the proceedings and asked for written memos. And so the hearing was postponed for whatever it was, 10, 15 days, and competing memos were submitted, which obviously allowed the attorney to really dig in and find some case law to support the fact. And in that case, even make some statutory arguments that because the child in that state is a recognized party to the proceeding, that the court rules were clear that parties have a right to be present. And so not only presented constitutional arguments, but was also able to really dig into the statutes as well. Unfortunately, the court did not agree with the lawyer and excluded the child, and there's an appeal ongoing in that case. So actually an opportunity to potentially set some important legal precedent. And obviously nobody's arguing for an absolute right for a child to be present in all circumstances in every single case. There may indeed be appropriate circumstances where a child can be excluded, but you know, at the appellate level, we can really tease out like what would that test look like? What would be the appropriate circumstances for removing a child from the court?
You worry that the exception would follow the, you know, the rule in places where anytime you throw in the word best interests, like it just seems to melt away.
Yes. I totally agree. And I mean, that's why, you know, I really think that anytime you're talking about curtailing a right, and in this situation, you know, we would argue that it's a fundamental right to be present in the courtroom, that you would have to have a test akin to strict scrutiny, you know, that the state would really have to have a compelling interest. Any removal from the courtroom would have to be short in duration and just really, you know, have a very narrowly tailored remedy for that situation. Really, the only circumstances I could think would be extraordinarily dramatic, you know, like if a parent had violently, you know, harmed a sibling, and there was going to be testimony, you know, about the harm to the sibling that a parent inflicted, you know, that might be a situation where you would remove the child briefly from the courtroom and before they came back in. I mean, it should be a high bar. It should be a high bar. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Out of curiosity, in working on these cases, are there ever such standards for adults, even incapacitated adults, to be excluded? Is that like what, because it seems like so often when they look at children's rights, they go to incapacitated adults as the right test, which is not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying it seems to be where they go. And so I wondered if there was, I literally don't know. I was just curious whether that was part of the analysis.
There's quite a bit of case law that discusses a parent's right to be present in the courtroom and when courts may proceed in their absence. But those cases tend to be situations where, you know, a parent had notice and failed to appear without good cause, and basically nobody knows where they are, or situations where parents are incarcerated and the prison or the jail failed to appropriately transport them or make the arrangements for them to appear telephonically or over Zoom, and whether the courts may proceed in their absence under those circumstances.
And again, I think it is sort of uncharted territory in the sense that I'm not, you know, aware that there's at least definitive case law on it. So I think that's probably why you like to do it. It's got to be fun to be figuring this out.
No, you're right. I mean, we are largely writing on a blank canvas here. You know, these are issues that have never been squarely presented to the courts, and so we are, in fact, you know, setting new precedent, making new law. But it's really, I think, it's fun work. You're right. But it's also a weighty work. You know, it's this, and you know this. This is a true of all of our cases. I mean, it can be real easy to lose sleep when you've got a kiddo who should be going home who isn't going home, or vice versa. There's a lot of nuance in this work, and a lot of stress because we know that it's so hard on these kids who are, you know. One of the things I like to emphasize is that when a child is in foster care, they have lost their liberty, right? Mm-hmm. Like the state is now, you know, they are now in the legal custody of the state. The state determines where they live, who they see, how often they see them, where they're going to school. And this is something I know that I've heard you and I've heard Jim and John say, the state is a bad parent. The state is a bad parent. And really these kids need stability, they need safety, and they need somebody in their corner advocating for them to go home or to find, you know, permanency through guardianship or adoption, and really move things along. So it's to root these arguments in the Constitution, it's a real privilege. It is.
Well, and I don't think we, you know, argue the liberty point enough, or even it's like almost too hard to stomach when you think about it that way, you know, to your point. And I will say we sort of have a distorted sense of fun in this field, but what I meant by that was, you know, I'm hoping to light a fire under some lawyers out there who are exasperated, you know, and who are, maybe they've been trying to get their clients to court and they keep getting shut down. And, you know, anytime we can offer a tool, another way where we could make a change that it would impact kids statewide or nationwide, that is exciting. And it is a real, you know, it is an area where there is a lot of room, and we could imagine the number of things we wouldn't have to argue if we could get this stuff established. So I think it's, I want people to be excited about it.
I want that people to be excited about it too, 100%. And I am certainly excited about it. I wouldn't have taken the time to write it. I wouldn't take the time to go across the country introducing it to people if I didn't believe it had the potential to have a truly transformative effect on our system. Because I think elevating kids' rights in the courtroom will ensure that we're doing everything we can to be child-centered in our practices and really working to make sure that their needs are met in a timely and safe manner.
And I think focusing on their rights and not just what we think in the moment is best for them is something that, you know, there's still a lot of resistance to that. But if you can get things established as a right, then, you know, the burden shifts instead of someone in the courtroom being a little worried about how it could impact a child who lived through it. We have instead a different standard.
Yes.
Where there is room if there's something extreme, but we're not having to, like, you know, it's not just sort of dependent on the judge, dependent on the guardian ad litem, the child's attorney. There's actually a different standard, which is exciting. So one of the things that we didn't cover in the intro was the center's referral network. And I did want to make sure you had a chance to talk about that and tie it maybe to this, the constitutional work that we've been talking about.
Oh, well, thank you for that kind reminder. As the center's work has expanded beyond Arizona, one of the things that we have seen frequently is individuals from out of state asking for help from our pro bono legal network or from our pro bono children's law center. And it's, you know, very difficult for us to justify going out of state when we're not litigating a constitutional issue. So we've been working to create a national legal network and connecting with law firms, law clinics, solo practitioners, medium-sized law firms, really anybody who's interested in this work, so that when people do contact us from outside of Arizona, we have resources for them to go and find help. Most of those resources are ideally legal in nature, but you know, we do have some partnerships with other nonprofits that provide services to grandparents who have taken in their kids maybe outside of the foster care system and aren't receiving state assistance, which, you know, it can be good and bad, but there are oftentimes existing resources in the states that they can tap into that are funded through private philanthropy. So we've been building this network, part of that is a two-way street. Not only do we want to be able to have resources for individuals who are looking to help, who are looking for help from us, but we want to be a resource for others as well. So, you know, we always try to introduce those organizations, you know, for example, to the practice manual, and let them know that we are ready, willing, and able to discuss cases with them, you know, about how to assert or preserve a constitutional argument, or if there's a case pending on appeal and they're looking for somebody to write an amicus brief or to join an amicus brief. We are always happy to take a look at those sorts of cases and issues and perhaps draft something and help out a friend who's doing good work in another state. But we really do. We want to be a resource and a help as much as find resources and help for those in need.
Well, that's a tremendous offer. And I think that's motivation for attorneys out there. If you're want to get started in this work, know that, you know, there is someone to reach out to if you get a case going up. And I think that's a tremendous offer. And I know we need all the support we can get out there. Some states more than others, but that's fantastic. Well, I think I would love it if we could go through all five of the rights that you have outlined, but maybe in another episode we can take them on, because I do think it's an area where talking through could really help. But for now, we'll wrap this one up. And before we do, though, just wanted to see if you had any parting words for our audience before we close out.
Well, first I'll just thank you for this time. It's so great. First time guest, but long time listener. so always enjoy tuning into the podcast. So it's nice to be here. But I would just encourage the lawyers to take advantage of the opportunity to, you know, go to the show notes or go to the center's website, download the practice manual, give it a look, and really find opportunities to assert these arguments. I think it could be a very powerful tool to protect the rights of children. And I would just love for them to have that in their hands and really put it in practice as quickly as possible.
Well, thank you. This has been tremendous. I know it will really help people out, and hopefully people are excited and can look forward to some of the fun, as we define it, of getting into this area of the law. But again, thank you, Tim, and thank you everybody so much for listening.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.